This is The Guardian.
Today, after a week of the COP26 climate summit in Glasgow, do the bold pledges to cut emissions all add up? At the start of the week, Boris Johnson warned his fellow world leaders that the planet stood on the edge of climate disaster.
This is very, very urgent for not just for our country, for the whole world. And if I had to give a comparison, I'd say it was a 1 minute to midnight moment, and the clock is ticking.
As more than 30,000 delegates from around 180 countries gathered in Glasgow, much of the city ground to a halt. Scotland reporter Libby Brooks was out on the streets.
You're sort of walking along to get to some events and you look up a side street and you see tons of police vans filled with cops and then again sort of more Mercedes with the engines revving, these sort of incredibly shiny cars with blacked out windows.
Behind the road closures, as close to the summit as they can get, protesters are making their voices heard. Inside the conference centre itself, the scenes are less colourful, but no less chaotic.
It's so busy and frantic, but also so weirdly airless. Everyone is in masks, which just does make it difficult to communicate. It's a very, very odd atmosphere.
The leaders laid out their plans for cutting emissions, then departed, leaving behind their negotiators. And Boris Johnson flew back to London on a private plane for a dinner with chums at the Garrick Club. Looking on, outraged protesters are demanding more from government. And tomorrow, there'll be protests around the world.
We're expecting in Glasgow up to 100,000 people marching through the city centre and up to Glasgow Green. We've got reports of marches taking place across up to 140 cities and towns in the UK. And of course, it's happening right across the world.
With a week to go, that doomsday clock is still ticking, and new analysis shows that carbon emissions are already heading back to pre-pandemic levels. For negotiators in Glasgow, a huge task is still ahead of them to limit global temperature rises before this summit can be called a success. From The Guardian, I'm Nosheen Iqbal. Today in Focus, inside COP26. After all the promises, what are the chances of keeping 1.5 degrees alive? John Watts, you're The Guardian's Global Environment Editor, and you're reporting from COP.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to COP. Welcome to Glasgow.
On Monday morning, Boris Johnson opened the World Leaders Summit. He addressed delegates with a speech laying out a very stark and serious message, albeit one in his own style.
Called James Bond, who generally comes to the climax of his highly lucrative film strapped to a doomsday device.
Referencing James Bond.
We are in roughly the same position, my fellow global leaders.
Who else was there in the room, and who notably wasn't?
So in the room were most of the world's leaders, including the USA President Joe Biden, the Prime Minister of India Modi, and many other dignitaries. The notable absences were Xi Jinping, the president of China. Of course, that's hugely significant because China is the world's biggest emitter. And also Vladimir Putin of Russia, Jair Bolsonaro of Brazil, and the leader of Saudi Arabia. So, you know, there's clearly a pattern there, isn't there, that some of the world's biggest emitters and biggest oil-producing or carbon-producing countries decided not to show up at the highest level, although some of their senior diplomats were there.
And the leaders who attended gave speeches to the hall on their shared ambition to tackle the climate crisis. But the summit's purpose is to work towards very specific climate goals. How exactly does it work?
This particular COP is a special one because it's one of the COPs that's supposed to be held every 5 years where there's a sort of a global stock take and an effort for everybody to kind of up their ambition in line with what science is telling them as the severity of climate change kicks in. The key goal for everyone is to try to get enough emissions cuts to restrain global heating as close as possible to 1.5 degrees Celsius. That's the best that we can hope for. But the idea is that as many countries come as possible with more ambition, more targets, that will take us closer to that goal. So that even if it can't be done this time, that the processes can be put in place so that possibly it can be done in future years.
I mean, as you've said, it's a monumental moment for the planet. Can you feel that sense of urgency in the conference centre?
Yes and no. The conference centres are slightly surreal places. It's the centre of what's happening in the world. It's the centre of the biggest crisis humanity's ever faced. But at the same time, there's this sort of otherworldly detachedness about COPs, where everyone's inside a bubble for a couple of weeks. There's lots of discussions, and it feels somewhat remote from where a lot of the impacts are happening in, say, the Amazon rainforest or among coastal communities. There's a lot of brilliant minds here, a lot of very idealistic people. Yes, sure, a lot of squabbling as well. But at least there's a focus on this huge challenge that we all face together, and an effort to come together to solve that. That's an absolute key. No individual nation can fix this. When I first went to a COP more than 10 years ago, there was still this big debate about, is the science real? Do we need to do this? And I think that debate at least seems to be over. And there is that sense that science has finally persuaded world leaders and a lot, most of public opinion in the world, that we need to act. That has helped, I think, to focus minds.
In the Paris COP of 2015, the world agreed that global heating needed to be limited to well below 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels. Since then, we've had this report from the IPCC, which said that anything above 1.5 degrees would be devastating. Now, at Glasgow, countries are being asked to bring their plan to reduce their emissions at a national level to the table. What have leaders come up with so far?
Well, it's been a process that's been going on for a couple of years now. Every country's come with what's called a NDC, a nationally determined contribution. And what was submitted 5 years ago, around the time of Paris, has had to be upgraded because since then, the world's scientists have told us just how much more dangerous 2 degrees is than 1.5 degrees. So the world's picked up its effort to try to keep warming at 1.5. So it's for some countries, that means a net zero target in the middle of the century. For example, the UK was the first to set that particular target. It is encouraging that in the run-up to Glasgow, more than 100 countries have set net zero goals, mostly by 2050.
President Muhammadu Buhari has pledged that Nigeria will cut its emissions to net zero by 2060.
President Moon Jae-in pledged before the global community that South Korea will cut its carbon emissions by 40% by 2030 from 2018 levels.
For other countries, it's a commitment to peak their emissions. That means, you know, reach the top level of carbon output. For example, China has set that target for 2030. And a few countries have actually come to Glasgow and announced their NDCs. So, for example, India, for the first time, came to the table and Modi announced to the world that India will reach net zero by 2070.
Varsh 2070 tak Bharat net zero ka laksh hasil karega.
Which seems quite a long way off and is, but it was the first time they set a net zero target. They are a big developing country that's got a very expanding population. And at the moment, the average carbon emissions of each Indian citizen are very low. So, you know, that was a big step forward and that got quite a lot of headlines.
What about now? Are there clear short-term promises within those targets?
There are. I think the most impressive part of India's commitment is that it will produce 50% of its energy needs from renewables by 2030. That means 400 gigawatts of renewable power, a lot of it solar power, within the next 10 years. And it's really a dramatic story there, because the solar take-up is so much faster than even the government had expected. So Modi's been able to come in and make a more ambitious promise than before. On Tuesday, I was invited to a press conference by the Indian delegation. So this is the foreign minister was speaking, and obviously India had made one of the headline commitments of the first day. There was one point where the foreign minister said that probably India will have the shortest gap of any country in between its peak emissions date and its net zero target.
China has said 2030 peak, 2060 net zero, so that's a 30-year gap. If India, doing the sums, I'm not great at maths, but 2070 as net zero, so you're saying you will peak after 2040.
And, you know, this is all nerdy geek stuff, but it's really important, because the difference of peaking between 2030 and 2040 is many, many gigatons of CO2. I wanted to drill down on that, and I asked him for a bit of clarity. The foreign minister just kind of dodged it and tried to suggest it was a bit, little bit too technical.
About the Guardian, let me just say that we're going to have a very detailed briefing where people will know the answers to some of the very complicated questions that you're posing. And I think...
Of course, other countries would like India to go even further, but I think first other countries have to step up and do more. So this is how the ratcheting process is supposed to work, that one country will kind of go a little further than usual, and that will encourage another to go a little further, and so on. So we have seen a little bit of this, but not nearly enough to reach that 1.5 target. By one estimate, and this is the most ambitious estimate I've seen, by a university in Australia, all the targets put together, if the countries achieve what they've promised to do, we might keep warming to 1.9 degrees Celsius. And that's the first time that has gone under 2 degrees Celsius. Now, I'd have to emphasize that there will be other calculations, and this is highly dependent on all the countries doing what they've promised, which is currently not at all the case.
I mean, how binding are these summits actually? Like, what accountability is there for the promises that are being made?
This is a key question, and it for a long time it was a bone of contention at COPs. When, for example, at Copenhagen in 2009, one of the reasons that ended very badly was that wealthy nations tried to impose very strict regulations on developing countries to say we need transparency, we need monitoring, we need to scrutinize everything you're doing. And it seemed quite intrusive. And that eventually was replaced by this idea of every country making its best possible commitment. And yes, everybody signs up. It's sort of as legally binding as you can get in the global system. But there's a recognition that ultimately it's sort of peer pressure from other countries and technological advances and action inside the financial sector that's really going to drive the change. Once political leaders have made the right declarations, set the right targets, and hopefully put in place the policies to push things forward.
Well, beyond those international commitments, there have been other big announcements this week. Can you take us through the ones that were particularly striking?
Well, I think there were two really eye-catching political declarations in the first few days of this COP. The one that really took my interest was on forests. More than 100 nations promised to end deforestation by 2030 and indeed start restoration. That's a big deal. There was also $14 billion put up to try and achieve that goal. It was very significant because there have been similar promises made in the past. But this time you have countries like Brazil, big forest nations like Brazil, and also China, who are signed up, and there is more money available. And there is also a component of this that looks at trade and promises to promote deforestation-free trade, because it always has to be recognised that it's not just the countries where the forests are that are causing the problem. And so if you don't address the financial incentives to chop down forests and clear forests for soy or beef, mean that no matter how hard you try to protect land, it's just not going to work because it's too rewarding to do the wrong thing. So that was encouraging. The second really big declaration was on methane, when, again, a large number of countries got together and committed to reducing their methane emissions by 30% by 2030. This is very important because methane is a greenhouse gas. It's between 30 and 80 times more potent than carbon dioxide. So if you can reduce methane quickly, you can buy time to reduce carbon dioxide. And methane, you can reduce quite a lot of methane if you go directly to the source. And there's essentially two main sources of methane. One is flares from drilling for gas or fracking, and the other is agriculture, you know, the famous cow burps and farts that are contributing, along with a lot of other things, to changing and warming the atmosphere. So these are two solid steps, and I think it's fairly clear that this was scripted in advance to make sure that there was a bit of a feel-good factor at the start of this COP, to try to create a sense of momentum. So I think kudos on both of those fronts. But again, let's see the details.
At these summits, as you've seen, a lot of the promises come with these heavy financial commitments. You know, and we've seen before that there was this $100 billion a year promised by richer countries for poorer countries to help curb their emissions and cope with the climate crisis. And that was back in 2009, and yet they've never met that commitment. I mean, it seems easier to wave a checkbook when the cameras are on, but a lot harder to sign that money off when the spotlight has shifted.
This is one of the key issues at this COP. It's all about credibility. Can countries trust each other? Some countries are being asked to cut emissions, other countries are being asked to stump up cash, and everybody needs to believe in everyone else to make this happen. You're absolutely right that that promise of $100 billion per year that was made in 2009 by the rich countries of the world, and it was supposed to go to the poorer countries of the world to help them make the transition to renewable energy and to deal with the impacts of climate change, that hasn't been met. It wasn't a total disaster. I think they got up to about 80 billion. And I think there is that sense of aggrievement amongst many developing nations that they're being asked to make a lot of sacrifices, not to cut their forests down, for example, and yet the rich countries of the world are not keeping their side of the bargain. So there has been some movement in this direction. The US has promised a little bit more money. Some countries of Europe, Japan, has also promised a little more money. And I believe the number has crept up closer to $100 billion a year. The other point on this that needs to be made is that even $100 billion is not enough. And that now that we are much more aware of the dangers of slipping to 2 degrees Celsius instead of 1.5, that actually we need to move more quickly than the world thought they had to move back when this promise was made in 2009. So, for example, Modi and the Indian delegation were saying, look, it's not enough to talk in terms of hundreds of billions anymore. We really need to be talking in terms of trillions.
Before the world leaders departed, Boris Johnson did take to the stage again, having initially said that the world was going into this summit like a football team, 5-1 down at halftime. He then said he was starting to feel more optimistic.
We've pulled back a goal, or perhaps even two. And I think we're going to be able to take this thing to extra time, because there's no doubt that some progress has been made.
John, you've talked about pots of money that are missing. We talked earlier about leaders that were missing. Can we talk about some of the missing commitments? Yesterday, more than 40 countries pledged to move away from a reliance on coal, including Poland, Chile and Vietnam. But there's no sign of China, Russia or the US, the biggest emitters, in that agreement. How big a concern is that for you?
This is very worrying because coal is the number one enemy of the climate. It's the dirtiest type of fossil fuel. It's also the worst for air pollution. And there is alternative technologies now. But our whole economies were, the Industrial Revolution was built on coal. And this has been the model that when countries start to develop, they first burn a lot of coal. And so you tend to see countries on their way up that are thinking, OK, I'm going to do the same thing. And if you could phase that out as quickly as possible, then 1.5 might really start to come in sight. And there has been positive developments in stopping coal financing. Japan, South Korea have promised not to do coal financing. Of course, China recently announced that it would stop overseas coal financing. So that should help to stop countries, say, like Indonesia or Vietnam or Bangladesh or Pakistan. It should help them as they develop to choose renewables rather than dirty coal. So mixed progress, but not nearly enough progress on coal.
Coming up, what does COP look like to the people living on the front line of the climate crisis? Libby, we've been hearing from John about what's going on inside the summit, but campaigners have said that COP26 is the whitest and most privileged ever, excluding thousands of delegates from the Global South whose voices desperately need to be heard. I mean, there's COVID restrictions and then the rocketing cost of travel, accommodation, which has made it impossible for some of them. But you've been speaking to the protesters that did manage to get here. Can you tell me what they've been saying? What's their experience been?
Something that I keep hearing from activists and protesters outside of the COP summit is just how exclusionary they feel this COP is. COP is not just about the people who are within this UN designated blue zone. It is also about civil society, about the activists, the charities, the young people, the indigenous groups who all converge in this kind of huge festival, really, of sort of events and actions that take place with that main summit. You know, people are really tired of the rhetoric and they're tired of false promises. And so they are not sharing Boris Johnson's cautious optimism about the outcome of this. They're very sceptical about what these negotiations can actually deliver. The other evening, we went to the south bank of the river where a group of youth and indigenous activists were holding an event, and they were holding up these illuminated letters reading End Climate Betrayal. And one of the young women that we spoke to was Mitzi Tan. She's the convener for Fridays for Future for the Philippines.
And we're tired of being told to keep up the hope. We don't need hope, we need action. And right now, these so-called leaders with their so-called pledges have done nothing but betray us.
And I was asking her in her speech, she sounded really angry. She was saying, you know, the leaders aren't in there, and gesturing across the river to the summit centre. She's saying they're right in front of me now.
And they're not the important people. They're not the leaders. The leaders are here. The leaders are you guys. The leaders are the people back home who can't even be here. The leaders are the people who can't even speak English. The people who are actually at the front line of environmental defense.
When I was asking her afterwards, she said, yes, there was a mood of anger amongst activists because, you know, they feel that she's already heard so many excuses.
I've already heard so many excuses. I've already heard how some leaders are not referring to below 1.5 degrees Celsius anymore, but rather close to 1.5 degrees Celsius.
Mm-hmm. At that event, we also met Chai Surui. She's the daughter of a tribal chief from the Brazilian Amazon. She actually gave this incredible speech to the conference on Monday.
The earth is speaking. She tells us that we have no more time.
And when we met her, she was wearing this incredible bird feather headdress that had been made for her by her dad and her uncle. It had been sort of fashioned out of bird feathers from the Amazon, and she said it had been made for going into battle.
Yes, um cocá para guerra, um cocá de luta.
This is like a fight, a battle. Okay.
Porque eles falaram, você é líder e você tá indo lá lutar pelo nosso povo e representar a gente.
Because you're a leader and you're going there to fight for our people and to represent us.
Yeah. And I think speaking to those activists in particular, what you are struck by is just the absolute immediacy of the threat that they are talking about. So, you know, I asked Chai Surui, for example, when she had got involved in activism, which I realise in retrospect is just a stupid question because, you know, she says to me, when I was born, if you're an Indigenous person, you know, particularly living in the Amazonian rainforest, then that's what you're having to deal with.
When you burn Indigenous people, you don't have a choice. You need to fight. Yeah. It's your life.
And did these women, did these protesters, all the people that you spoke to, do they feel that their communities, which are, like you said, amongst the most vulnerable, do they feel they're being properly represented in the COP discussions?
I think they're very suspicious about how they are being represented. Certainly they're aware that some Indigenous voices have a bit more access this time around. But I think, you know, what they're suspicious of is that delegates will, you know, listen to their terrible, sad story and nod along and actually just continue with what they were planning to do already.
John, the world leaders have left and now we wait on the outcome of the more technical discussions happening behind the scenes. What exactly are the negotiators deciding on?
So from here on, the COP is going to be focused on the really important nitty-gritty details of how to achieve those big promises. So negotiators and technical experts and scientists will be looking at each nation's commitments and saying, well, by 2030, are you doing enough? How are you going to achieve this? Give us roadmaps. Are there ways that countries can all put in their plans and have them evaluated, so there should be more rules on staging posts along the way? So that will be a big part of it. And the same should also be true of finance. There will be a financial package announced, and it should be more than the 100 billion that was initially promised. So it's a lot of work on credibility. That's, for me, that's kind of the key word of this particular COP. Everybody proving to everyone else that they're going to do what they've promised. And then I think that the politically contentious issues, there will be a big discussion about Article 6, which is all about trading of credits. For example, if you pay a forest in the Congo or Indonesia, the people who operate that forest, if you pay some credits, does that allow you to pollute elsewhere because you've kind of one's cancelled the other out? How do you prove that that's going to work? How do you stop double counting and cheating? And that's been a really contentious issue. And then finally, I would stress that a key could be what countries are going to do next. One move that's been proposed is that instead of coming every 5 years with new climate plans, countries should come every single year with new climate plans. So this idea of ratcheting up, this idea of kind of nudging each other towards more ambition should become an annual thing. So that could be quite contentious, but that might be one of the positives that could come out of this COP.
Do we have a sense of how well it's going?
It really depends who you talk to. I think the hosts are very happy with what's happened so far. Joe Biden flew back to the US saying a lot of very important progress has been made, but that's what political leaders do, of course. But interestingly, though, quite a lot of people on the ground seem to feel that there has been just enough progress in this first week to maintain a sense of momentum and also, if not full optimism, a belief that there is cooperation and things are moving in the right direction. It's still not fast enough, but in terms of the big public statements and the progress that's been made over the past five, six years, I think there has been some ground made up, and that there's a lot of good work that can be done based on this.
John, finally, we're not even through the first week. Tomorrow we'll see huge protests in Glasgow and around the world demanding more from governments. But as we stand today, is a hope of keeping 1.5 alive?
As we stand here today, the hopes are slipping away. Yes, governments have stepped up their commitments somewhat in the run-up to this conference and during this conference, but we're still off course. At the very best, if everyone keeps their promises, we'll probably be closer to 2 degrees Celsius, and most likely, because there's bound to be a lot of slippage, we'll be heading above 2.5 towards 3. So there does need to be so much more progress, and that's why those protests in the streets are very important.
Climate justice!
Leaders need to know that their electorates and their citizens want change and are encouraging them to be more ambitious. It's not impossible. Every scientist I've spoken to has said it is still possible. It's a matter of political will now. It's not a technical issue. Definitely can be done in terms of technology. It's not really an economic issue because the money can be made available. We've seen just how quickly renewable energies can become cheap. So it's all a matter now of overcoming the old vested interests and driving forward really quickly, almost at the scale of a wartime mobilization to reach 1.5. Because as long emissions are still creeping up, I mean, ultimately that's the measurement. And if emissions don't go down in the next 1 or 2 years, I think all of these lovely promises we've seen in the last few days and the last few years, they'll be meaningless. It has to be acted on, and it has to be acted on very quickly.
Well, let's hope for that. John, thank you so much.
Thank you. Very welcome.
That's it for today. My thanks to Libby Brooks and to John Watts. Do read all their reporting on COP26 and keep up with the environment team's coverage at theguardian.com. For a daily fix of what's happening on the ground at Glasgow, please do subscribe to our sister podcast, Science Weekly, from wherever you get your podcasts. On it, the team will be dissecting the very latest developments on what's happening inside COP26. I'd really recommend a listen. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin, Courtney Youssef, and Hibag Farah. Sound design is by Rudy Zagadlo. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Archie Bland. We'll be back on Monday.
This is The Guardian.